We call the order. Call to order the Energy Finance and Policy Committee. We do have a quorum present. So let's get the matter of the minutes out of the way. Representative Magnus moves approval of the minutes from February 5th. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The minutes are adopted. Representative Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Back to the hot seat.
Thank you.
Members, we have today testimony on the schedule from Xcel Energy and a couple other entities as well. First up would be this Betsy Engelking from Xcel Energy.
And Mr. Chair, if I could make a comment for the record, it would
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'd be, I think, appropriate to, even though everybody in the room realizes what the Senate just did, and that there's an agreement and things like that in that body, and if we could keep our comments directed towards House File 4, the bill that's in front of us.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. I would echo that. I think that's a very good thing to keep in mind. I should say also, members, at the outset, a couple of things. One is, where are we meeting in? Our next meeting will be on Monday, February 12th, but on Tuesday, February 13th, we have arranged for a joint committee meeting, our committee and Representative Eakin's Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. That will be held at 4 o'clock next Tuesday in Room 5. And that will feature testimony on renewable resources. Dr. Tillman from the University of Minnesota, Cheryl Miller, and Andy, where is, no, I don't remember offhand this Miller's affiliation, but anyway, that should be a very interesting presentation, and hopefully this has been arranged. I think we've checked with all of the committee members, and there may be only one or two members that would not be free at that time. But if it is possible for you to make that meeting, I think you would find it very valuable. I should say also that we have been notified that Representative Westrum, who is the Republican lead on this committee, is not going to be able to be here today, and for that reason, and because we do have people that are interested in speaking to this bill, we will not be taking up amendments to the bill today. We will do that on Monday, and hopefully we can move the bill out of this committee on Monday. So with that, Ms. Engelking, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Engelking, and I am Manager of Resource Planning and Bidding for Xcel Energy. I appreciate the opportunity to make comments to you this afternoon on House File 4. In 1994, Xcel Energy was the beneficiary of one of the first renewable mandates in the country. It was 425 megawatts of wind. At the time, we owned about 3 megawatts of wind, and it was an extremely ambitious standard. And over the years, that standard has been continually reviewed, revised, and increased. And it's been done so in a manner that has created a lot of different requirements for Xcel Energy with respect to renewable energy. Just to name a few, we have requirements that are based on megawatts or capacity. We have requirements that are based on megawatt hours or energy. We have requirements that are technology-based, that are based on project size, that are based on ownership, and that are based on geographic location. Over the years, we've started to call these different requirements buckets. And every time we acquire a project, one of the questions that we have to answer is, okay, what bucket does this fit in? Sometimes it fits in more than one bucket. Sometimes they're interdependent. Sometimes they're mutually exclusive. We have worked very, very hard at fulfilling all of the requirements the legislature has put on us up until now. In fact, Xcel Energy in 2006 became the largest wind energy purchaser in the nation, among all of our three operating divisions in Minnesota, Colorado, and Texas. In addition, one of the things that we found over time is that technology is advancing and state policy is advancing, and in many cases some of these buckets are becoming obsolete or have been superseded by additional policies. A good example of that has to do with some of our requirements to do under 2 megawatt projects. Right now, the minimum turbine size for many of these projects is a 2.1 megawatt turbine, which means we can't do an under 2 megawatt project. It would require something like 3/4 of a turbine. And a lot of the purpose for requiring those small projects to have projects that were small enough to be conducive to local ownership or to keep local dollars in the community have been superseded by community based energy development policies, which allow the aggregation of much larger projects for ownership benefit. Some of our buckets are set to expire. The original 425 megawatts that was required in 1994 was simply a requirement to sign contracts for 425 megawatts. Those contracts will start expiring in 2015. And so as we move forward and we look at House File 4, and it's very clear that this legislature of the state of Minnesota is ready to move forward and set some, you know, fairly sweeping policy on renewable energy, we also believe that this is a good time to take a look at our requirements and to clean up some of our buckets. House File 4, as it's currently written, would impose a 25% standard on Xcel Energy by 2020, and yet would not allow us to count some of those original mandates that were put into place. It ends up being approximately 5% of the renewables that we have put in place that we're not allowed to count. Now, our utilities president, Mr. Paul Bonavia, had an interesting take on that. He said, only in Minnesota would they require 30% and call it 25. Everywhere else, they require 25, and they let you count things that, you know, aren't even close in order to put things forward and say that we met the standard. We believe that as we look forward to this standard, one of the things that Xcel Energy needs to get is credit for 30% if we're going to be required to do 30%. And so our proposal as we look at House File 4 is to say, let's clean up these buckets. Let's stop having to decide whether a project is a 2-megawatt project or whether it's a project that goes at a megawatt standard, a megawatt-hour standard. Let's just set a requirement for renewable energy from eligible technologies. And in exchange for that, we believe that it's appropriate to have recognition for those earlier mandates that Xcel was required for, as well as our advanced achievement. By the end of this year, we expect to have more than 1,300 megawatts of wind online. And for that reason, what we're looking at is a proposal that Xcel Energy, rather than accepting the 25% standard, not including the mandates, would look at a 30% standard by 2020 and the opportunity to count everything that we do in terms of renewables toward that. This is a very aggressive standard. In fact, it is the largest standard that has been adopted for any utility in any state in the nation. But we look forward to the challenge of meeting it. In order to do that, the other thing that we request is that we're given some tools to do that. And one of the tools that we believe is extremely important is the clear authority to own some of the wind generation that we put in order to meet the standard, and the authority to recover our costs for the wind energy that we put in, regardless of the ownership structure. Right now, when we purchase wind under contract, we make an energy payment, and it all is recovered from our ratepayers through our energy adjustment clauses. If we invest in turbines, we don't have similar provisions to recover those capital costs. And so another thing that we would look forward to working with you on would be an ability to clarify those issues, the issues of ownership and cost recovery. Those are all the comments that I have right now on the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, Ms. Engelking, regarding what you just mentioned as the authority to own wind, could you tell us what you see as the obstacles to that and the remedy?
Mr. Chair, we do actually believe that we have the authority to own any of our generating resources, subject to our processes at the Commission of Competitive Bidding, and the Commission has just recently set up a new process that makes it very clear that there's a special way to go through bidding if we want to own. The biggest question right now in the legislation on whether or not Xcel Energy has authority to own came in the 2003 legislation that dealt with storage at Prairie Island. And there is a clause there that says Xcel Energy can own up to 100 megawatts of wind. And we've had some concern from people who have looked at the legislation that may in some way limit our ability to own more than 100 megawatts. And we want to make sure that that's not the case, that that's not the intention.
Just to follow that up, do you recall why that language was in place in the first place and why the up to would have been included?
Mr. Chair, I actually wasn't with Xcel Energy at the time, so I'm not sure why that language was included. I think it was related specifically to the 300 megawatts that was required in Prairie Island, but when you read the language now, it's not entirely clear.
Representative Wagenius, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mrs. Engelking. When Minnesotans talk to us today about the various buckets, the bucket that folks are most interested in is the low-carbon bucket. And renewable energy is one of the ways to get to that low-carbon bucket. So the fundamental question is how much renewables, how much wind do you need? What should be the standard if instead of just increasing the rate of carbon, you are actually reducing the rate of carbon that you produce?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, we have done some very, very preliminary analysis on this. And when we look at a 30% standard, along with our other initiatives, which include a proposal we recently made with the Commission to fulfill our next base load need with a combination of Manitoba hydro and wind resources rather than a new coal plant, and the life extension of our nuclear plants, that a 30% standard would allow us to remain roughly at 2005 carbon levels for the next 25 years.
If I could follow up?
Yes, Representative Wagenius.
And that's where you are right now? When you say remain, that's what you... It won't change. Is that what you're saying to me?
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, yes, in 2025 and 2030, our carbon emissions would be at the same level as they were in 2005.
Well, Ms. Engelking...
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We all know that our goal is not to remain at the same, but to reduce. How are you projecting to get to a reduction.
Ms. Engel King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wardenius, we're still working on those plans. One of the things that you need to look at when you look at Xcel Energy's portfolio is you need to look at how much of our portfolio is already carbon-free. In addition to the renewables that we are projecting, we also get about 25% of our energy from nuclear plants, which don't emit carbon, and we also obtain about between 8 and 10% of our energy from Manitoba Hydro, which is also a carbon-free resource, but not one that's an eligible energy technology. So if we look at a 30% standard plus our nuclear, plus our Manitoba Hydro, we already have 60% of our portfolio that's essentially carbon-free. We believe that at that time, we have right now only three major coal plants left on our system, the Sherco plant, the King plant, and the Black Dog plant, which is also nearing the end of its life and which we're going to have to be looking at some repowering scenarios. We will be working as we move forward on those parts of the system, looking at ways that we can come up with low carbon and no carbon methods of obtaining new resources and repowering old resources in order to achieve those reductions. But at this point, we're not that far along in our planning.
Minnesotans are going to be very interested about when you get there. That's the new bucket.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In looking at the bill here, House File 4, on page 4, line 426 through 28, and I testify, Ms. Engel King talked about the new production and new manufacturing of turbines now being at basically 2.1 megawatts or larger. That's what they're producing in the Pipestone plant in my area, I'd like to have a little better understanding just what that language in the bill here means to you. How do you access turbines that are less than 2.1 megawatt, if that in fact is the industry standard now, what the cost would be, what the ramifications of all that is, and is this possible for you to do?
Representative Magnus, could you just repeat your reference here for those of us that were shuffling paper while
It's page 4 of the bill of House File 4, Mr. Chairman, on line 26, and it references the 2 megawatts or less wind turbine.
Great, thank you. Ms. Engel. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, this is precisely one of the problems that we are reaching right now. While there are projects or turbines that are smaller than 2.1 megawatts that can be available on the market, and in fact you can even get home individual turbines that are as small as 10 kW. One of the things that we are very interested in is balancing the project size and the cost of the project. As you start putting in these smaller projects that are not the state-of-the-art, newer, larger turbines, your projects become much more expensive, and they end up costing our ratepayers much more money. At the time that this bill was passed and this consideration was made, the reason that we looked at under 2-megawatt projects was an attempt to get local ownership of projects because small local owners could not afford to buy into these 100-megawatt projects that were being done by the large developers. Since that bill was passed in 2003 and 2005, we came up with another concept that would allow us to look at local ownership. It's called community-based energy development, and to this date, since the 2005 legislation was passed, Xcel Energy has signed contracts in excess of 200 megawatts of community-based energy development projects, which are projects that produce benefits for local owners, but yet can be larger in size and therefore take advantage of the cost competitiveness of larger projects. We believe that that's actually a better tool to obtain local ownership, and that the 2-megawatt requirement is obsolete because CBET has replaced that.
Well, Mr. Representative Magnus, I guess one of the things I'd like to know is that
If you do, in fact, put in a smaller turbine than the state-of-the-art size now, are they able to access the transmission lines and get the electricity to the utilities? And because I know I'm speaking from experience here, I have a lot of people that would like to invest in turbines, and we're having tremendous problems with transmission lines. And I certainly want to support local ownership as much as possible.
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, I'm not the right person to talk to you about transmission, and we certainly have people in the company who are able to do that if you're interested in that question. However, we have recognized the barriers of smaller projects interconnecting to the transmission system, and that is actually an issue that we've been trying to work out as part of the governor's proposal for increasing some of the or reducing some of the barriers to seabed projects being put on the system, and so hopefully we will be before you at you know some date soon talking about how we can help reduce those barriers.
Just one final point, Mr. Representative Magnus. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one final point is my understanding then that under this bill, that the 100 megawatt of less than 2 megawatt would be required yet from this time on? Or is that from days in the past? Is this a new requirement under House File 4? Maybe Representative Peterson can answer that. I guess I'm a bit confused about this.
Yeah.
Ms. Engelking or Representative Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, this was actually a requirement that was placed on us in 2003. It's not a new requirement.
Thank you.
Representative Finneau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about one of the handouts. You gave us these Excel handouts. And under challenges with the REO, you talked about 15% of all Minnesota-based wind and biomass allocated to Xcel's Wisconsin standard doesn't count towards the renewable energy objective. And that raises somewhat of a red flag to how you're actually, I mean, you have customers in many states and you produce energy in many states, and how basically this sounds to me is it's being counted in Wisconsin, so I wouldn't think it would be counted here. And is that problematic for you, or is that the same? I just don't want our renewable energy counted in two states, just two renewable energy objectives based on numbers of customers in those two different states. So if you could walk me through how you calculate how much of your renewable energy counts towards a state's renewable energy standard, even if it's not produced in that state.
Okay. Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I apologize that I was supposed to mention the handouts and I forgot to. there were two handouts that were given to you before the meeting. One of them just discusses our position on the RES, and the other one provides a summary of our renewable and conservation activities to date, so you can see what we've done so far. In response to your question, Representative, currently, Xcel is subject to two renewable standards, one in Minnesota and one in Wisconsin. And it is a hallmark of a renewable portfolio standard. One of the things that we are always looking at is the issue of double counting. To the extent that you're using a renewable credit to fulfill one requirement, you can't use it in another state. In our arrangement with Wisconsin, right now, 15% of all of the renewables on our system are allocated to Wisconsin in order to fulfill that mandate. And that is the proportion of retail revenues that we obtain in Wisconsin. The Minnesota company is made up of three states. It's made up of Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Minnesota is approximately 75% of our total system, and each of the Dakotas is approximately 5% of our total system. We do not have any renewable requirements in the Dakotas. So when we look at our renewables, and this is based on some commission orders and our resource plan, we allocate our remaining renewables in either one of two ways. 15% of everything goes to Wisconsin. We have 85% left. if it is something that we are putting in place solely to satisfy a renewable standard, we allocate all of that remainder to Minnesota, because we would not be building it but for the Minnesota standard. If it is a system resource, something that we are putting on because it is the lowest cost resource for our consumers on our entire system, we only allocate the up to the 75% of sales to Minnesota, and then North Dakota and South Dakota get the benefit of their 5% each. So what we do is we look at it on a project-by-project basis, and we petition the commission according in our resource plan according to how we believe that it should be allocated, and they review that, and they would approve that when they approve our resource plan. But we don't double-count anything.
Follow-up, Representative? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. I had a question about the green pricing program, and if you could say a little bit more about that. I've had some constituents ask me about that and how it actually works, and how will it be affected by as we move to these renewable energy standards and wind energy increases for our power source.
Samuel King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. The Green Power Program is a program that allows our customers to voluntarily purchase a portion of their energy from renewable energy. And right now we have the wind source program, so it's all wind energy. It is energy that we wind energy that we purchase specifically to meet those customer purchases. We don't include it in any of our standards. We don't count it toward our renewable portfolio standard. So I always think that you look at sort of the renewable standard and a green pricing program in conjunction with each other. The renewable standard is sort of the minimum amount of renewable energy that the legislature has decided should be in a consumer's energy portfolio. So the legislature will look at it and say, you know, we believe it's appropriate for 25% of your energy to come from renewables. A green pricing standard is for people who want to get more of their energy from renewables. And the way that Xcel Energy does that is we sell it in 100 kilowatt hour blocks on a monthly basis. Our customers pay a premium for that that is in line with the cost of obtaining the additional resources over and above what they would pay in their embedded rate. And so in that case, the customer can say, well, I want to buy 100% of my energy from renewables, and they're able to do that. The programs can work in conjunction with each other. They're not mutually exclusive, but I know that there have been some comments, and I'm not sure about the language. The language of House File 4 actually does repeal the green energy requirement or not. I know that there's been some language that has, that is saying, since everybody's getting 25%, you know, it's okay. But I think one of the issues of a green pricing standard is that it is a voluntary standard. Customers can choose to sign up for it, and it's the ability of the customer to decide that they want to have more renewables than what's already being offered in the standard utility portfolio.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Engel King, I want to talk a little bit about something that's been going on over the last 3 or 4 days here, but let me just preface it with this observation. On Sunday after church, my wife and I were driving up the hill to our house, and of course that curve lets us look right at your Blue Lake peaking plant, which is just down the hill from our place. And I noticed the orange smoke was rolling out of the bunker fuel powered generators, which apparently you fortuitously left in place whenever it was upgraded to natural gas here 2 or 3 years ago. And that one was going too, oh, by the way. And I thought, oh boy, it was really cold on Sunday when we were all getting ready for the Super Bowl, and Blue Lake had all 5 generators running full bore. That's a peaking plant, mind you, very expensive one to run. So I guess I wasn't surprised when on the news over the last couple of days, public service announcement, and in this morning's paper, they're talking about pleas from every regulated utility, electric company in the state, asking us to not run our dishwashers and our washing machines, dryers, and so on and so forth during the middle of the day, because we're down to like 600 megawatts of reserve capacity in the system. That's less than 4% now. And I think we've got an electrical reliability standard. We'd like to be around 15 or 18. We're down to 4 right now, have been for several days, which that's thin. But what I'm thinking about, though, is, and I'm seeing here that the transmission line that is trying to come up from Buffalo Ridge, which took us a lot longer to get to agreement on than I think it needed to, but it's not done yet. How much power, since you're in charge of resource planning and bidding, can you tell us how much power we're actually pulling off the grid or the ridge right now? Is that contributing to the crunch we're in at the moment, or is we all leaning on natural gas and peaking plants at the moment? That's the first part of my question, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, unfortunately, I don't know exactly how much power we're pulling off the ridge right now. This does tend to be some of our windier times and when the capacity factor of those wind turbines are up, but that was one thing I didn't look up today in preparation. Based on what I can tell you in terms of the Excel system, even though we work very, very hard to keep all of our facilities operating, particularly in very cold periods and very hot periods, sometimes we do have some unfortunate occurrences and facilities will trip offline. Right now, one of our 500 megawatt coal units, King, is out of service for the metro emission reduction upgrades and won't be back in service until in April. And so that one is already, it was planned to be out of service. And unfortunately, Sherco Unit 1 tripped off, which is another about 650 megawatts. And that is one of the things that's led to the crunch. In addition, with the very cold weather, some of our contracts have been having some difficulty operating on oil. And so we have, even though we've planned for more than enough energy capacity to serve in these cold situations, we've had a couple of unfortunate situations in the last couple of days that have led us to call for conservation, and we're very pleased to see that Minnesota people respond and help out when that does happen.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ma'am, then, thank you for that. I guess it spurs another question. So the fact that we're down to 600 megawatts of reserve at the moment, that already takes into account the King's offline, or a portion of the King plant's offline. Did that also count the Sherco unit tripping?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, yes, it does.
Okay, thank you. And then I just have one other different question of a different nature. You've got nearly 300 megawatts of hydro in Wisconsin that I don't think we count here in Minnesota. Wisconsin allows you to count 15% of that for your Wisconsin version of your REO, correct? But we don't allow you to account any of that. The other 75 or 85 doesn't count in Minnesota.
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, under the current commission orders on implementing the renewable energy standard, we are allowed to count those resources, 75% of those, toward meeting our current renewable energy requirement, which is 10% by 2015. So the commission looked at those and said, we recognize that those are eligible energy technologies on your system, but because they are system resources, and these are the resources that are put in place because they're the most cost-effective thing for our customers, you can only allocate to Minnesota the amount that's proportional to your sales in Minnesota, and that's what we do right now.
Good. Thanks for clarifying that. I appreciate it.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Engelking, I'd like to follow up on Representative Knuth's question. You mentioned that when a resource is added that's the lowest cost resource, that it will not count towards the RES. But I just want to clarify, I'm having some trouble here understanding that we are changing the economics of renewable power by passing an RES, hopefully for the better. If we're changing the dynamics and renewable generation becomes the lowest cost resource, is 100% of that count as towards the RES, or do we come to some sort of calculus that changes? I'm just trying to figure out exactly how this all works out.
Ms. Engel King.
Mr. Chair, Representative, but let me clarify that, which is if a renewable, what I said is if a renewable is a low-cost resource, a least-cost resource, and something, that would be something that we would put in to serve our customers regardless, because that's our objective, is to install our lowest cost resources to serve our customers. We plan the entire NSP system as a single system, Wisconsin, Minnesota, North and South Dakota. And so the allocation becomes different. If it's a low cost resource, we allocate that to our entire system so that only 75% of those megawatt hours would count in Minnesota. If it is something where we have to go beyond the least cost readings and say, we have to, this is not our least cost resource, but we have to install this because we have a mandate to do that, then we can come to Minnesota and say, we're only installing this in order to meet a Minnesota mandate, and therefore you need to allow us to count all of it toward Minnesota or all of it, less the 15% that has to go to Wisconsin. Certainly it's our hope that these renewable standards do end up all being the low-cost resources on our system. That's going to be the best thing for our ratepayers. We hope that as we see things continue with technology improvements and pricing trends, that we will find that all of these resources become low-cost resources on our system.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you. That helps a good bit. I think it then leads to the next question, which is, we've heard the term based on the 2.49% anticipated annual growth in demand, that about 5,700 megawatts of more renewable power will have to come online to meet the requirements of House File 4. What I'm hearing you say is that at some point, if the calculus changes between, and we reach that critical mass where, let's say, wind becomes the least cost, lowest cost resource, that actually only, at some point, only three quarters of what's being added to the system is applied to the RES. So we may be talking about significantly more than 5.7 gigawatts of new renewable power. Am I doing this math right, Representative Peterson?
Mr. Chair,
Ms.
Representative. Yeah, we can get confused about megawatts and gigawatts and things like that, but it is true that for XL Energy, if we are installing 100 megawatts of wind to meet an RES, only 75 of that, the energy from 75 of that will count toward the Minnesota standard. So there will actually be more wind installed. Now, some of that will be meeting a mandate that we also have in Wisconsin, and so that it's... it's all renewable energy that is, you know, goes to our customers and is paid for by our customers and is good, but it may be a larger amount that's installed in order to meet the Minnesota standard. Now, that's particular to XL Energy because we are a multi-state utility. There are other utilities that are also multi-state utilities that have other allocation methods, so you would need to talk to them specifically to see how those work.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, just also want to connect to what Representative Beard was bringing up, and this the issue of supply versus the, you know, the available reserve supply, and certainly the push towards conservation. One of the things that I remember in being involved in the Chisago project years and years ago that astounded me was when there was a crisis, when there were brownouts, that the first thing that happens is you pick up the phone and immediately call your biggest users and you call for conservation. And I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, in terms of reliability, I mean, seconds are literally worth thousands of dollars at that point. You want to make sure that you're closing that gap, dealing with the crisis at the moment. We don't want to have that kind of urgency, but if it's, you know, where we're talking about seconds being worth thousands of dollars. But I do think that tying this stuff together is kind of the direction that we're going here, especially with House File 4. We need to do something about conservation. We need to do something about efficiency. It's the easiest way to increase reliability in the system, is to bring greater technology to the fore to do that. We can, if we affect that, the demand curve optimistically, and can drop it down a little bit, as the governor is calling for and others. It not only makes the standard under House File 4 easier to achieve, it also recognizes that, that the peaking power that we need can come from wind and other renewable sources, but also that this calculus we were just talking about with the 75% versus 100% of the economics change, that we, even by reducing that demand curve, do you agree that we may, if not likely will, but certainly it's a high a decent possibility that we will meet and exceed that 5,700 megawatts of new renewable power coming online? Do you track that that preamble? But I think it's a, does that make sense?
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me give a crack at this. I do keep track of what Xcel would be required to do to meet this standard, and we actually become, we're about half of that the standard. I think you'll see here that we provide about 49% of the retail kilowatt hour sales in Minnesota. And our, you know, what the thing we think in terms of is that, and looking at the 30% by 20 that we've proposed, it's approximately 4,000 megawatts of wind on our system. We'll have 1,300 megawatts online by the end of this year, and so that's an additional about 2,700 megawatts of wind. If you consider that that's about half, then, you know, the other half is about another 2,700 megawatts, and that gets you right in that 5.4, 5.7 ballpark that you're talking about. I think that the issue of conservation is a very interesting and important one to talk about. Xcel Energy has had very aggressive conservation programs for almost 20 years at this point, and in fact, conservation programs have already avoided about 6 large power plants on our system. They've been extremely successful, and you know, we look forward to continuing that dialogue on conservation. We do believe that in many cases we have obtained a lot of the low-hanging fruit that exists on conservation right now, and so while we're always looking at ways of going deeper and trying to do more and trying to get more savings, particularly in partnership with our largest customers, since that's where the best savings are, we also recognize that it's going to be very, very difficult for conservation to even to wipe out even what our expected growth is in the next year. So we will, or the next several years. We'll look forward to continuing that dialogue, but we already do work pretty aggressively on conservation.
One last follow-up, and I appreciate the indulgence, Mr. Chair. Looking at the statewide goal here, then, in terms of both the RES and conservation, then, it does seem like conservation and becoming much more efficient in adapting new technologies and making sure that the new buildings that come online, literally online, are performing better, are more efficient, that we're getting more with less energy, getting a higher quality of life with less energy, and getting cleaner energy to supply that. It seems like if that demand curve is dropping a little bit, logic and my 7th, 8th, and 9th grade math tells me that 25% of less is less, or 30% of less is less, or 20% of less is less. And so it does seem like these two things do go hand in hand here, and they move us forward together. And so I would hope that Xcel and our utilities recognize the statewide approach here with the RES, and then also recognize that we all are partners who are in the same boat, we're on the same, you know, in the same challenge here. Do you agree that it's easier to get 25% less if the total is less?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, to the extent that we're able to reduce our demand through conservation, that's fewer kilowatt hours of renewable energy we'll have to obtain to meet the standard.
Right. Thank you.
Members, are there no further questions? Thank you, Ms. Engelking, for enlightening us today. And next on the agenda we have Mr. Wayne Brandt. Minnesota Forest Industries.
Thank you, Chairman.
Brandt, welcome to the committee.
My name is Wayne Brandt. I'm Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries. and our members are primary manufacturers of forest products, pulp mills, paper mills, engineered wood products manufacturers, and sawmills. I do have a handout in front of the committee. Thank you for the chance to speak today. I hope I don't have the same standard as the previous speaker of being required to enlighten the committee. That might be higher than what I can reach, but I'll give it a stab. The forest products industry here in Minnesota has been a leader in the use and generation of renewable power. With our partners at Minnesota Power and on the co-op system, we generate 28% of the electricity that we use as an industry. 4% of that comes from hydro at the dams at four paper mills, dams that have been there since the inception of those paper mills. And the balance, 24%, comes from biomass, ultimately in our operations, coming from the trees themselves. With the biomass that we used for fuel, about 1.2 million tons of that is bark from the debarking process before we make the products. You know, I think we've all been around Minnesota long enough to know that Hormel has always said in the hog processing that they use everything except the squeal. Well, we use everything, including the bark from the trees when it comes onto our property. I had to try. The balance
knew that was coming, Mr. Grant.
Well, you approved it earlier today, Mr. Chairman. The balance of the material that we generate electricity from is organic material from the trees that comes out of the pulping process for making paper. In our industry, that's commonly known as black liquor. And without indulging the committee too much, that black liquor is neither Kahlua nor is it Amaretto. It is the material in the pulping process, the craft pulping process. The trees are actually cooked. They're chipped and then cooked. And that cooking process in digesters separates the cellulose that we make paper out of from the balance of the material. So what comes out in this black liquor is lignin, which is the material that binds the fibers together, the wood fibers together from the trees. It is hemicellulose, which is the type of cellulose that more readily dissolves. And then there's a little bit of cellulose that comes out. The cellulose is what we make the paper out of. That's about two-thirds of the volume of the black liquor. The other third is fully recoverable sodium salts that are used in the cooking process to separate the fibers. Those that material is recovered, reused in our processes on a continuing basis. So that two-thirds, that's the lignin and the hemicellulose primarily, is then it's liquid, it's dewatered, and then burned in the recovery boilers to power turbines to generate electricity. So basically that's how we go about generating the electricity that we do ourselves. We have, with our partners, invested about $500 million in the generating capacity that we are operating. We have ongoing investments, obviously, on a regular basis to maintain those facilities and to upgrade them and keep them up to standards. Additionally, we use a fair amount of biomass for non-electrical uses, again, primarily bark and undersized material. That's used to create process steam and heat that's used at the plants. And at sawmills, it is also used for drying lumber. And in these uses, it's a direct replacement for both natural gas and fuel oil. I know this bill is directed at electricity, but I just wanted to mention some of those other renewable uses that we have. We think we've got a pretty good track record on doing this and developing these types of power. We would hope and ask the committee, as you go forward with this legislation, that you recognize the record that we have in this process, and we have a fairly simple interest. We kind of feel like we've already done the objective that you're seeking on a statewide basis. We're at 28% already. And we would hope that we would not be charged in the process for others to come up to where we are. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions from members? Representative Wiggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Brandt, the bucket we're trying to fill is the low-carbon bucket. Help me out here. Are you on a path to reduce your carbon footprint?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, you know, I thought you were going to ask that question since you asked it of the previous witness, and I don't have an answer prepared for that, but I will certainly get one prepared and be happy to get back to the committee. My guess off the top of my head is that given our activities in growing wood fiber, growing trees, forest management, that we probably have a pretty good record, but I don't have any substantive facts to share with you today, but I will get those.
Representative Wagenius.
I would appreciate it. Our new competition is who's going to fill up the low carbon bucket the fastest.
Representative Beard.
I'm glad Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius brought that up, because I'm trying to find that in the bill, but it is a clarifying point, because as we look at the purpose of this bill, some of us are trying to grasp what it is. Is it low-cost, dependable energy? Is it a rural economic development project? Is it because we're trying to slate manufacturing in rural Minnesota with turbines? Now we hear it's carbon. I'm hearing about a perfectly sensible and balanced approach at using biomass. But if carbon now is all of a sudden the hurdle we're trying to clear, then the raw malt project in my district doesn't qualify, because it burns a plant-based material, and I think it emits CO2. In fact, I think as we're sitting around here, we're putting several pounds of CO2 in the air just by breathing. So I guess and we'll let the witnesses speak, and I'm not going to ask the witness to respond to this, obviously. But as we go forward, I would appreciate some clarity on just what the mission is here.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Representative Beard, there's never one mission, and we have opportunities for win-win-win-win, and I think that's what we're all looking for.
We shall see.
Other questions for Mr. Brandt? Mr. Brandt, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Hilton. I appreciate the opportunity.
Keep in touch. Next on the agenda, we have an Hankel. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Hankel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Annette Hinkle, and I'm with the Minnesota Utility Investors. And I don't have any sense of humor. I don't have any humor to follow Mr. Brandt's testimony, so I apologize up front for that. But we do appreciate the opportunity to express a few concerns about House File 4. When I testified or spoke to you a couple weeks ago, we expressed a strong preference for the renewable energy objective, the process that is currently in place. And I'm reiterating those comments. We do feel that that is the way to go. It is a process that has been proven to work. The companies, the utilities are meeting the objectives that the legislature laid out. And we would encourage the legislature to continue down that path using that process. However, it does look like the legislature is not going to go down that path. So just a few other things to talk about when we talk about standards and imposing penalties. That we encourage you to do it in a very deliberative and gradual approach. And one of the concerns that we do have with House File 4 is that it is much too aggressive. You heard from the Public Utilities Commission, the Wind Integration Study, that talked about, yes, 25% renewable energy is doable in Minnesota, but, and there's a big but, if the transmission is in place, and there's been a lot of talk and a lot of discussion about transmission, it will be there, it won't be there, how do we do that? It is going to take, to build that kind of transmission, to do that 25% will take money, resources, and time. And we are encouraging you to emphasize on the time to get the system up to the level that it needs to be to carry that kind of renewable energy resources. The other component I just want to mention, and I mentioned before, is the recognition that each of these utilities are different. And to keep that in mind as we talk about standards, House File 4 does have the recognition that the Public Utilities Commission does have the ability to modify or delay the standard. We appreciate that. We would encourage you and your committee to flesh that out a little bit more, have recognition of the customer's cost, the concern about getting the equipment, transmission, and again, going back to transmission. If you are going to impose a standard, to give the Public Utilities Commission the ability to have each of the companies the flexibility and the ability to kind of present their case in trying to meet these standards. And with that, Mr. Chair, that's all my comments. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions, members? Sankal, thank you very much. And next and possibly last on the agenda, we have Mr. Crocker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is George Crocker. I'm the Executive Director of the North American Water Office, and I'm on the Seabed Steering Committee. Seabed, community-based energy development, of course, is in statute a framework for negotiating power purchase agreements. It's also an organization that is intent on getting us the tools we need in order to get enough renewable energy development in time to really make a difference from an environmental perspective. I very much appreciate the comments of Representative Beard when he talks and asks about really what is the objective. And I think Representative Wagini has had a really good response when she says that there's multiple objectives that need to happen if we're going to get enough to make any difference. And I would submit to you that is a lot. If we're talking about making a difference for our Earth, for our children, for the times to come, we're going to have to do an awful lot more than 20 by 20 or 25 by 25 or 30 by 30. We're going to have to do a lot of it. We're going to have to change our way of thinking about how we provide ourselves with the goods and services we enjoy, because if we don't, the erosion of our ecological foundation will do it for us. And so what this discussion is about is how to make those changes in our thinking, those changes in our relationships with the Earth and with each other, so that we can do enough and do it in time. And with that in mind, I would submit that House File 4 is a good start, but it is just a start. It sets some numbers in play. And as I said just a minute ago, I don't think those numbers are enough, even aggressive as they are, to really make the difference that we need to make for our children. And that means something that Betsy Engelking said is very, very important. And that's the tools. What are the tools that we're going to put in play in order to get this job done? Now, there's a lot of discussion that has been about what those numbers are and what are the consequences if we don't meet them. But I would submit the more important question is how are we going to get the tools we need in order to get it done, so we don't have to argue about off-ramps and traffic jams on off-ramps when obligations become due? How can we do this in such a way that we can be successful? And so those are the tools that we need to consider. Now, I recognize the step-by-step approach, and I sit here kind of as an article of faith that we will be back to deal with the tools that we need, the community-based tools that we need. And I'm going to articulate just a little bit of those with the idea that I will be here and Seabed representatives will be here to flush those out as the toolkit comes forward to how we are going to meet this agenda. But there are some really important things that we can identify right now. And Representative Kalin's notion about conservation, I think, is one of those things that we really need to get involved with, because we waste. Right now, we waste over half of all of the electricity we consume compared to providing the same goods and services that we want, the lights, the refrigerator, or whatever it is, that function, relative to the most cost-effective option for providing that service. We waste over half of all of the electricity we consume. So there's tremendous opportunity once we get the incentives right, so we're rewarding the efficient use of our resources rather than their wasteful consumption. Those things are on the demand side. The other tools I'm going to talk about just briefly are the supply-side tools that seabed needs, community-based energy needs, in order to really help fill up that carbon bucket enough and in time. And one of them has to do with transmission analysis. You heard Mike Michaud's testimony a week or so ago about how we can develop the transmission system in such a way so that right now and in the intervening 6 years between now and 2012 or 2013, we can do literally thousands and thousands of megawatts on a community-by-community, substation-by-substation basis here in Minnesota to take advantage of that short-term opportunity and do it in such a way that it augments and invigorates the local economies of communities throughout the state of Minnesota. So as we move forward, be mindful of the transmission tools that are at our disposal if we're smart enough to take advantage of the good thinking that is available on how to do that. A second has to do with interconnection. How do we connect those power turbines onto the grid, recognizing that this interconnected grid is it's the biggest and it's the most complicated and the most expensive machine that humans have ever built. If you stop and think about it, it's one machine from coast to coast and border to border. It's an interconnected grid. It has to work together. When the transmission engineers try and figure out how to balance things, they have to use the square root of negative numbers. We're into imaginary zones here as we figure this out. So it is complicated. It's terribly complicated, but it's the kind of thing that the state exercising its authority up to the interstate level, the state recognizing its authority at intrastate commerce, can provide a role, and you'll see language that comes forward on how the state can help us do that so we get more efficient, more cost-effective, quicker at queuing up projects and getting them online to serve the utility needs that we all use pretty much all of the time. So that's another tool to be mindful of. We do need, as inflation causes costs to go up, we do need to take a look at the tariff rate, which is right now set at 2.7 cents. Per kilowatt hour net present value over power purchase agreement. And I would urge members to remember that when we're talking about 2.7 cent net present value over 20 years driven by the utility's cost of money, this is a really good deal. This is the only commodity you can go anywhere and get that you can be pretty sure will be cheaper 20 years from now than it is today by a significant amount, because that cost of capital is amortized over that period of time. So we do need to adjust that. We need to enable these projects to cash flow is the bottom line. And we can come forward with the tools we need in order for that to happen, and we look forward to bringing those tools forward for your consideration. Finally, and maybe even most importantly, well, very importantly, is the idea of partnerships. How do we define community-based energy development? What's in that and what isn't? Who is paying for the infrastructure that we need to bring this to market, and who is profiting from it? Where does the wealth of the harvested resource from Minnesota go? Who's making those decisions about how it's used for tax purposes or schools or hospitals or corporate coffers far away? How does that all balance out? Who can we partner with, recognizing the difference between Minnesota utilities that we use all of the time, where their shareholders are equity owners are Minnesota citizens, part of the Minnesota community? Is that something we should be mindful of as we figure out how these large economic institutions who have access to capital at much better rates than you or I, at least I do as an individual, who have access to economies of scale much more so than most of us on a community organizing basis, how can we take advantage of the economic levers that they can pull while bringing the political capital that communities in Minnesota represent to put the infrastructure in the ground to do this job and to do it right? So those are among the tools that we will be bringing forward. We look forward to working with Representative Peterson and the other authors of the energy legislation. We think that we are poised right now for some truly remarkable success. I mean, I've been at this, some of you know, I've been at this business for quite a long time. And for most of my career, talking about these issues has very much been like taking a pillow into the middle of the woods in the middle of the night and yelling into it for all the resonance we got. Well, now here we are talking about how to do it right, how to do community-based energy, how to do it right, how to get enough carbon and other pollutants into that pollution bucket, put the lid on it, and have a earth for our children and for their children. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Crocker. Questions from members? Representative May?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Crocker, I understood you were a power line protester in your younger days.
Mr. Crocker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Magnus, not only them.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to suggest I've got a new vocation for you. If the executive director there doesn't work, I think you ought to be a pastor. I'm moved by your presentation. That was great. George, you did a great job.
Thank you, Representative. It is true, to be a little more serious about it. I was involved with the power line protests across west central Minnesota. I was involved with the Chisago project. I'm still involved with the people who are being abused by the Arrowhead Weston development that wants to go from by Proctor Duluth down to Wausau. The point here is that we all use the electricity. We all use it all the time. We're all part of this problem, and that means we all have to learn how to be part of the solution. So we all use it, so we need infrastructure. We need facilities. We take advantage of these vibrating electrons. And so that means we have to get more intelligent about what infrastructure we develop. I'm not opposed to power lines for ideological purposes. I am very opposed to abusive development of infrastructure to profit the few at the expense of the many and the earth. Thank you.
Anything further, members? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Crocker. And members, let me remind you, please, if you can at all possibly, put on your schedule the joint hearing that we will be having next Tuesday, 4 o'clock in room 5. Representative Peterson, did you have anything further?
A little bit, I guess, is that, Mr. Chair and members, is that some people clearly don't like this bill as one of the tools to get to a lot of the opinions of members on this committee as it goes forward. Some might say a renewable energy or electricity standard is just myopic and too narrow and not comprehensive enough. But, you know, I started talking about this, you know, in 2003 with the encouragement of senior members. And not, you know, others have been talking about it longer than that. And meanwhile, we have argued our way out of getting any more megawatts into the, whatever you want to call the MISO footprint or the biggest machine in the nation, over other issues like ownership and transmission. And I call it the big farmer versus small farmer discussion. And that what's too big of a farm? And what's a small farm? And who owns too much of this land? And who rents from this guy? And who doesn't get that access? And, you know, it becomes very contentious and almost mean-spirited in small communities. You know, I understand the concerns around ownership and transmission to a certain extent, but I'm not a transmission engineer. And, you know, I don't finance personally wind projects. But those two things have driven us away from passing a bill in the last 3-4 years that I've been working on this issue. And those opinions aside, we haven't increased the number of megawatts of renewable energy that we're going to be requiring utilities to do that service retail customers in Minnesota. So you can take your ownership concerns and put them aside for a while, and take the transmission concerns and put them aside for a while, and the off-ramp concerns, and the this and the that and the other things, and use as a tool to get towards many, many buckets that everybody's interested in getting some megawatts, not eating each other alive. And I'm not looking
you know, for just a party line vote on this, or just 68 votes on this eventually. I think we owe it to a lot of people to move ahead on the number of megawatts, and one way to do it is the renewable electricity standard. It's not that complicated. Many states have it. So let's not eat each other alive over the weekend and try to get something done. Sorry, Chelsea, but just kind of, I don't want to have my brain eaten here. You will. So thank you for that, and I hope we can get some megawatts here this session, and then move ahead on the other parts and tools needed that Mr. Crocker and others have referred to for the first month of session here.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Peterson, we do have a renewable energy standard today. I was part of a meeting in 2001 that we established, the first one in the nation, I believe. And we evolved.
That's incorrect, Texas, I believe.
I will be very happy to say we were second. The point is that we have one today that we're almost meeting on the correct timetable, and we are now trying to, with your bill, increase that standard, and I certainly applaud that effort. But to say that we don't have one, and we shouldn't have, you know, we have one. And it's a voluntary one that the power producers are standing up to the plate, and they're getting there on a voluntary basis without any penalties or anything else. So please correctly state that we do have one.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Guthrie, I just respectfully disagree with the voluntary part of the standard. I mean, you can just use your vote to vote no then. Just vote no.
Members, we'll get to amendments and the markup of the bill on Monday. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.